From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And there's news today that 13 sailors from the USS Theodore Roosevelt have tested positive for the coronavirus for a second time after recovering from the infections they got during that outbreak on the aircraft carrier back in March. The Navy said the sailors had tested negative for the virus at least twice after getting sick, but have now tested positive again and are getting care in isolation at a naval base in Guam where the ship is docked.
Their story renews questions about whether or not recovering from COVID-19 builds immunity in the future, something that is critical as states ease restrictions on public life. Auto manufacturers among the businesses reopening today as tens of thousands of workers return to plants across the U.S. and Canada after nearly 2 months. Let's bring in Phoebe Wall Howard. She covers the auto industry for the Detroit Free Press. And Phoebe, today was the first day back on the line for those workers. They returned to health screening, swabs, temperature checks. Can you describe what it's like right now at some of those plants?
Here's what we're seeing and hearing. It's quite incredible. First of all, the early reports from plants all over the United States show that actually turnout was much higher than expected. The companies planned for absenteeism today, figuring that the very intense screening would filter out more people, and they wanted a backup plan. In fact, the screening has not eliminated people, so the plants have more than they expected, and the enthusiasm among workers is greater than expected. Each shift can have more than 1,000 individuals. You have factories that may be the size of 30 football fields. So these are enormous operations. And so imagine when you're in line for TSA at the airport, how few people that relatively is. Now imagine a factory setting and that similar kind of security situation.
Yeah, I would imagine there are some difficulties with all of that on the first day. What are some challenges that they're taking up at this point?
One thing that they've planned for that frankly have addressed the challenges early is even though the plants have been shuttered, you had workers go in early and set up things and test things. So on a volunteer level, you did have hourly workers go in an attempt to make this a smooth operation. And obviously this is not just auto assembly plants. This is engines. This is transmissions. Again, to some, it's shocking that this is 51 plants opening on a single day. All over the U.S. and Canada.
So to put this in context for us, we're not talking about them back in a full production schedule capacity. How long will it take for the industry to actually get to that point?
General Motors has said that they expect to be up within a month to full capacity. And by full, it's what it was pre-coronavirus. Obviously, the automakers will track sales and track supply and build as much as they need to make sure stock is prepared for retail purchases. So they're optimistic, frankly, that they're going to be up and running. Some plants that would have three shifts have two. But these are workers, they'll be working 10-hour shifts. This is very serious, getting back in, catching up, and compensating for the downtime over 2 months because of the coronavirus.
We're wondering, is it even possible to practice social distancing on an assembly line? What is that going to look like for folks?
Hourly workers are very concerned that, in fact, it is not possible to practice social distancing on an assembly line, that it is a mere reality that you have to work in close proximity. Some of the UAW leaders have said they are going to use welding curtains and creative techniques to create barriers. Of course, they will also include face masks and face shields, like the ones used by medical professionals and first responders, gloves, other things like that. But the concern is real, and only time will tell.
Let's talk about the economics here. So auto manufacturers have really lost out on billions of dollars in sales during the shutdown. What kind of impact is this having on the auto industry financially? Could we actually see layoffs as a result?
The potential impact is devastating. So Ford Motor Company reported a $2 billion loss with just a few weeks of the coronavirus. That's a company that's expecting a $5 billion loss in the next quarter. So this is really a brutal, brutal situation. In addition to that, we're monitoring the auto suppliers, all the little parts. And what's happening with money right now is those parts suppliers are having to build and they're not getting paid. It's just the process of how the revenue works. The situation is fragile and being watched carefully.
How are we comparing this, or can we even compare this to what happened back in 2008 with the automotive industry?
This situation is widely considered to be far worse because the entire country is financially in crisis in ways that can't be controlled in any manner. You can't target a single industry and help it because so many industries are pleading for help. So while the auto industry is going to need support, it's a major economic driver in the United States. So this is a much more dynamic situation and potentially frightening situation.
That's Phoebe Wall Howard. She covers the auto industry for the Detroit Free Press. Phoebe, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, speaking of cars, one of the weird side effects of the coronavirus is fatal car accidents. Now, there are fewer in about 20 states. CBS reports that in California, the rate of deadly car crashes dropped an astonishing 84% as people stayed home and off that state's huge highways. But in some states, the rate of fatal car crashes has gone the other way, even with far fewer cars on the road. Louisiana, Missouri, Minnesota, Massachusetts are among those seeing many more traffic fatalities than a year ago. Why is that? Lisa Freeman is the executive director of the Louisiana Highway Safety Commission. Director Lisa, what are you seeing?
Well, as you've mentioned, more people are dying on Louisiana highways since the COVID-19 restrictions went into effect, even though there are fewer cars on the road. And that's a concerning disconnect. The statistics, I think, bottom line, are indicating that too many drivers are engaging in risky behaviors that put themselves and others at risk of serious injury. And that is unfortunate given everything else that we're working with in this pandemic environment.
Why, it's kind of crazy, you know, avoid COVID-19, but get killed on the highway because what? I mean, you're seeing an 8% increase in traffic crashes compared to last year. Is it just people seeing a wide open road and speeding?
Well, we have preliminary data, Robin, and that has not identified a singular cause that it underlies this spike. Oftentimes, it's a combination in the traffic safety world of other factors where it's distraction of one or multiple things. It's impairment. It's sometimes it's aggression and aggressive driving on the roadway. Sometimes all those things combine, you know, to cause a real tragedy. What we do know is that even though the world has changed and is continuing to evolve through this pandemic, the coronavirus did not change the rules of the road. Traffic is lighter. That is correct. But that doesn't mean that anyone should drive impaired or fatigued or distracted. Drivers still need to follow speed limits, wear their seat belts, and follow the rules of the road.
Well, it's funny you mentioned this because I was out just doing a quick errand the other day, and everything was empty. You know, it's so eerie sometimes. It's like a twilight zone. And I almost went through a red light, you know, because you feel like things are different. Everything is different. But as you say, everything is not different. You still have to obey those orders. And it's not just cars. We're understanding that because more people are walking or riding their bikes, there are pedestrian fatalities.
Absolutely. Here in Louisiana, there is an increase, and the Governor's Highway Safety Association has reported that there are other states where they've seen increases, and that 2019 was the highest pedestrian fatality year since 1988. So Louisiana is not unique in that respect, but as you know, there are so many people who are out walking and biking normally, but especially with transportation restrictions and travel restrictions still in effect. And so you have many more adults and children that are out and about. That's a good thing, but it does put them as vulnerable road users at a higher risk. In fact, they're 200% more present in the communities these days. I think that there's some federal databases. The Trails and Rails Conservancy has indicated that walking and biking have increased as much as 200% since the global crisis. So we Wow. have to be aware even more so, and so, you know, significantly aware that we're impacting, you know, all of these vulnerable road users.
Well, and as you say, it's a good thing when people are maybe getting some air, getting some exercise, enjoying, hearing nature, which they can because there's no din, no roar of traffic. Hopefully they're doing it while social distancing and wearing their masks.
Yes, let's hope. Yeah. Let's hope they're doing that. They're buckling up, not speeding, and showing patience, you know, with others. We know that our healthcare heroes, they already have their hands full with this pandemic. We do not want to add motor vehicle crash injuries to their workload.
That's true. Lisa Freeman, Executive Director of the Louisiana Highway Safety Commission. Lisa, thank you. Take care.
Thank you, Robin. You as well.
More European countries relaxed lockdown restrictions today. Schools in Belgium reopened. Poland's beauty salons, restaurants, and cafes are back in business. Italy, the country with the third highest coronavirus death toll in the world, is also easing its restrictions today. Let's check in with the BBC's Mark Lowen. He's on Skype in Milan, the epicenter of the outbreak there in northern Italy. Mark, the lockdown went into effect March 9th, so what is reopening today?
Well, Robin, I'm speaking to you from Italy's oldest department store, which appropriately enough is called Rinascente, or Rebirth. And that is a sense of how Italy is feeling today. It is coming out of 10 weeks of lockdown. 2 weeks ago, there was some reopening of takeaways and parks. But today, restaurants and bars, cafes, museums have all reopened, hairdressers, beauty salons as well, and church services also have been reopened to the public. There are strict controls that are happening inside this shop and in all the shops, really. I can see the staff now checking the temperature of everybody who comes in. There is one door to come in and one out. When you come in, there are hand sanitizing points. Staff have an app to show how many customers are in the store at any one time. There's no more makeup testing that is happening. And even in the changing rooms, for example, we watched the disinfection that is happening there regularly. And all the clothes that are tried on are not replaced on the rails. They are taken up to a separate room. So it's almost like they themselves are in quarantine, even right. though Italy is no longer.
We heard that from the CEO of Levi Strauss here in the States. He said that they're going to do the same thing, quarantine the tried-on clothing. But we know there in Italy, over the weekend, the prime minister admitted there's a risk to this. So what's the thinking behind it? I mean, what kind of levels were they seeing that told them they could do this?
Well, he called it a calculated risk, and he's basing that on the fact that over the last three months, Italy has been to hell and back, really. The deaths now are almost 32,000. The cases have come down to a much, much more manageable level. So the infection rate is now at the slowest that it has been since the outbreak began. And, of course, Italy's economy has suffered. There was a need to kickstart the economy again, to revive the economy, but also a feeling that Italy has got the outbreak down to a much more manageable level and to a level in which they can begin to bring these essential services and kind of social life and things that Italians depend on for everyday existence back into reality.
Well, before I let you go, it's later in the day there. What's the sense you get of whether people are apprehensive about going out? I mean, are people going out?
They are going out. I mean, we were in a church earlier on this morning for a mass, and it was quite well attended. The church service there also has its own control. So the priest, for example, when he hands out the communion wafer, he does so with gloves, and he does not place it in people's mouths, but only in their hands. The priest said to me afterwards, it was rather bizarre feeling to have the body of Christ on latex gloves. Parishioners who I spoke to there were very happy to be out, very moved. This is a region that has seen almost half the total number of deaths in Italy, over 15,000. So there is also a sense still of astonishment over what has happened here. But Milan feels ready to get back on its feet.
Fingers crossed. The BBC's Mark Lowen in Milan, Italy. Mark, thank you.
Nice to talk to you.
Well, here in the U.S., at least 150 kids are thought to have pediatric multisystem inflammatory syndrome. This is the new illness thought to be caused by COVID-19. There have been cases in other countries as well. And now the CDC has sent out a warning to pediatricians with criteria for diagnosing it. Kids must have fever, inflammation, and at least two organs that are affected. One is often the heart. Also key, they must have tested positive for COVID-19, have the antibodies that show they previously had it, or had a known exposure 4 weeks before the onset of this syndrome. Doctors say it shares features with Kawasaki disease and toxic shock syndrome. Some kids have suffered cardiac arrests, including one little boy whose brother saved him with CPR. Amber Dean is a mother of an infant, a 3-year-old, and 9-year-old Bobby Dean, who's recovering from this syndrome. An Associated Press reporter kindly hooked us up, and Amber joins us now from her home in Hornell in upstate New York. Amber, how is Bobby?
He's doing good. Doing a lot better today. Got more of an appetite, not as tired.
How are you doing? This must have been a shock.
Yeah, it was a bit of an experience, bit of a roller coaster ride.
Well, let's go back to the beginning of it. You had recovered from a mild case of COVID-19. And then what happened with Bobby?
We had been back to work for about a week when Bobby got sick. It started with what we thought was a tummy bug and then just progressively got worse. And by Tuesday night, he was complaining of pain, like a severe pain in his abdomen. His temperature spiked. He couldn't keep anything down. So we ended up in Strong in Rochester. And his COVID test came back positive, and they were concerned about his heart because it was beating rapidly. And the way they described it to me, it was beating as though he was running around when he was just sitting.
Wow. And we should say, upstate New York, gorgeous. You're there in Hornell. But that's a haul up to Rochester. How many hours was that?
It's not too bad. It's about an hour and a half. I mean, he groaned after every bump, so luckily the highway isn't too bad right now because people aren't driving on it as much as they normally do.
Did you have any clue what it was? We spoke to a Dr. Sood who's treated 2 dozen cases, and he said the symptoms can mimic appendicitis. So did you think maybe it was that? What did you think?
Well, actually, before going to Strong, he had been in the ER here in Hornell, and they were actually thinking it was appendicitis. And they did a CT scan, and they sent it to his primary. The primary looked at it and consulted a pediatric surgeon who said that, yeah, he had a stone in his appendix, but the size and location of it would not cause any problem. So they did the COVID test at his primary's office, but it takes like 24 hours for it to come back. And they just said that if anything were to happen to give them a call, which obviously that night is when his fever spiked and everything got worse. And that's when they said, go to Strong.
Yeah, go up to Rochester. If you just tell us a little bit, I can't imagine seeing your little guy there in the hospital. We've seen pictures of kids with tubes, completely knocked out, a lot of red rashes, red eyes. What were you observing?
Well, he did have the red eyes, and they had him hooked up to a heart monitor. They had put a PICC line in, which is essentially like a big IV that goes into a vein next to his heart, something that they can keep in longer than a regular IV. And his dehydration, it was bad. I mean, they wanted a urine sample when we first got to Strong, and he could barely give them anything, and what he did give them, it was like syrup. And it just was that fast. I mean, he went in a 2-day period, and they actually said that with the way his dehydration was, if he had gone another 24 to 48 hours, we might have lost him.
Oh, sure, the organs start to fail, right? And oof.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, my. I can't imagine how you're feeling through all that.
4 of the 6 days he was in the hospital, he was in the pediatric intensive care unit. I mean, I've seen some cases where the kids definitely have had it worse than him, but even what he had, I would not recommend because it's not easy for a parent to watch. You know, he's hooked up to all these machines and you're literally just there. You're not able to do anything.
Well, you know, COVID-19 feels like an invader from another world, you know, and here, you know, something has invaded your little boy. I mean, just horrible. And I'm wondering, in the hospital, this is so fresh. Rochester, of course, a very sophisticated hospital, but did they know what this was?
I'm not sure at what point they came to that conclusion, because they didn't come out and say it. His first night in the hospital, my husband had sent me an article that he found about this inflammatory syndrome, and they said at that point that, you know, they weren't comfortable saying much. It was after they did a couple of COVID tests. They did one daily for 4 days, and the first two came back positive and the second two came back negative, which they said that tells them that he came to the hospital at the tail end of the COVID, but his symptoms were still there, which was telling them that it was the syndrome that was causing this. And that was the first time they had mentioned it. And then they kind of explained to me a little bit what it was, because up to that point, I didn't really know anything about it.
Well, doctors are also cautioning that we start to see these weird side illnesses when there are millions of people infected. This is an illness that's affected millions around the world, and so a rare condition, there's going to be more. Maybe 4 to 6 weeks after an epicenter has an outbreak, you might see kids with this. Have they said anything to you about some vulnerability he might have had, or is it just a crapshoot?
Well, I was actually talking to his pediatrician, and he said that they're really not sure why some kids will get this and some kids won't. So it's just one of those, you know, you watch for the signs of it. You watch for fever, rashes, diarrhea, vomiting, and just don't hesitate to call a doctor. I mean, no problem's too small. They won't get mad. It's what they're there for. But it's definitely not something you want to ignore. But he said that they really don't know why some kids will get it and some kids won't. It's all new. They're still learning.
Well, Amber Dean, how has this affected you going forward? It's gorgeous up in your neck of the woods in the summer. As you look ahead, though, are you thinking of keeping your kids closer for a while? I mean, how has this affected you? I don't know, maybe psychologically even, as you look ahead.
I definitely think I'm going to be keeping my kid, you know, kind of out of the public for the summer. If things do start opening up and things start clearing up, we might do a couple small, like, family trips. But for the most part, they're only going to be around family. I'm not going to do any major gatherings or anything. And I'm not considering anything like a summer camp or anything like that.
Keep everybody close.
Close and have someone watching them at all times, and just in case. I don't want my younger two to go through this. And I mean, it was hard enough for the older one. I couldn't imagine it with my young ones.
Yeah, no, I can't either. That's Amber Dean. Her 9-year-old son, Bobby, is recovering from pediatric multisystem inflammatory syndrome, thought to be caused by COVID-19, which she also had and fought off. They're there in Hornell, New York. Amber, we wish you and the whole family full recovery, great health, as good a summer as you can. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, and thank you.
Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell is warning that we will experience the biggest shock our economy has had in living memory, suggesting that we may not see a full rebound until well into 2021. The Fed chair has been speaking out about this over the last few days, saying that both Congress and the central bank may need to do more to help businesses and workers. For more, let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News and host of Jill on Money. And Jill, Powell spoke yesterday to CBS's 60 Minutes. How typical is it for a Fed chair to speak out like this?
Well, Powell has been on our broadcast previously, and certainly prior to Powell, we had Chair Ben Bernanke coming on to 60 Minutes to talk to the country, essentially to reassure the country. But, you know, if you go beyond that, it's really interesting. If you go back to, say, Greenspan, he never spoke like that. He never went on a public program, a big national broadcast to do that. In fact, every time he spoke, you kind of needed a decoder ring to understand what he said. I thought Powell was very straightforward in his interview with Scott Pelley, and I thought that his message was clear. It's time for Congress to act.
Yeah, let's listen to something he said yesterday.
I would say, if I may, that policies that help businesses avoid avoidable insolvencies and that do the same for individuals, keep workers in their homes, keep them paying their bills, keep families solvent.
Yeah, you know, Jill, it's not necessarily his job to give Congress policy advice. We know the House passed this new $3 trillion relief bill on Friday. It's expected to fail in the Senate. Republicans are not sure they want to spend this money. But is it this kind of spending that Powell has in mind when he's talking like this?
You know, I think that he was quite clear that when he says we are trying to avoid avoidable insolvencies. What is he saying? He's saying, okay, There are small businesses, there are large businesses, and there are individuals who have a liquidity problem. They don't have cash coming in. They're sidelined from the labor force. The business is shuttered. So what do we do in those times? Well, the Fed can move in, the Fed can lend money, but the government is the only part of this three-part system that can actually write checks. The Fed can lend, and Congress can spend. And he's saying Congress has got to spend to help these individuals remain solvent. In other words, we want to avoid bankruptcies, and it is avoidable with congressional action.
Yeah, he also brought up a second wave of the coronavirus and its impact on the economy. What more did he say about this?
Well, he's very concerned, as almost every economist that I'm sure you've had on the air and that I've spoken to, about what would happen to the psyche of American citizens if we had a second wave. And that's why so many economists are trying to keep the lid on this and really connect spread of the virus with economic recovery. And I think that's essential. What we are worried about is if we have a leg down, if we recover and then we go backwards, it's tough to come out of that. We really want to try to maintain what we have now, which is the containment, and then the economy will be able to recover.
That's Jill Schlesinger. She is business analyst for CBS News and host of Jill on Money. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
South Central Los Angeles is one of many food deserts in this country, areas where residents have little to no access to healthy, affordable food. Ron Finley grew up in South Central, raises children there, and knows all too well what it's like to drive nearly an hour in LA traffic to buy a fresh apple or tomato. It's a mission that's even more heightened now during this COVID-19 crisis. I spoke with Ron Finley last week about the power behind learning to garden. Well, you have this masterclass as part of the masterclass series. After watching it, I spent all of last weekend planting flowers in a vegetable garden box. The sun was out, and then the next thing I know, I looked up and it was twilight. I had been working on it for several hours.
You got seduced based on your by class. The soil.
Yes, seduced by the soil. And that is what you're all about, really, empowering people to kind of grow their own food and fall in love with the soil. You say it's more than practical. It's actually freedom, especially for those who don't have access to fresh food. Can you say more?
We need to know where our food comes from. That's, to me, where the freedom part comes in. You know how to feed yourself. You now know how to feed others around you. You understand the plant world. I mean, this is something no one can ever take from you. It's a life skill, and we all should know how to feed ourselves.
But how did you know that this was your passion? You know, you were a fashion designer before this. When did it come to you that, like, this is what I should be doing with my life?
Everything I do is my passion. You know, fashion became a passion out of a necessity of me wanting clothes that fit my body as a kid, as somebody 15, 16 years old. And I said, okay, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do it really good. And the same thing with personal training, the same thing with the gardening. My thing is, if you're not going to do it, don't do it. If it's not going to be your passion, if you're not going to change the standards, don't do it. I mean, I'm here to show people how to be creative. This is like an art form for me, and that's how I treat it. You know, and I think we all should inspire each other, and that's what I'm trying to do.
This is really interesting because, you know, in light of the coronavirus pandemic, we've been talking a lot about food chains and the food supply, where we're getting fruits and vegetables from and meat from and all of these things. And we're learning just how complicated the process can be. We're also spending so much time now in our homes. And one of the first things I thought about when we were going through the whole process of, can we go to the grocery store? Should we wear masks? Are places like South Central LA, where there are food deserts, where people have to travel so far just to get to a grocery store. I mean, part of the proposition that you give is that, hey, you can do this at home. You can be in the comfort of your home and
it's so simple to be able to grow, and you don't need all the fancy tools and the fancy, a big plot of land to do it. You actually don't need much of anything to do it.
You don't. And that's why I think it should be taught in school. This is a survival system. And right now with this pandemic on us, people are seeing just how important food really is and how hard, if you have a situation, it is to get. You can't get to the store. Your store should be your front yard, your side yard, your backyard. And now we understand that you can't eat diamonds. You know, so what's truly, truly important in life? Here in places like South Central and places around the world, we must realize that these, I call them food prisons, they're by design. It's not happenstance. If you want healthy food there, they could have it there just like they have it in other neighborhoods. There's not a food shortage. There's a distribution problem that's by design. To me, I have a simple saying, beauty in, beauty out. If you want beauty into a place, you put it there. And you know what comes out of that. Beauty's going to come out of that. But if you have people hungry with diseases and that are curable, this is what you're going to get, this kind of cesspool. And that's what we're trying to change at the Ron Finley Project. And with this masterclass, we're able to reach around the world. And I'm seeing amazing results.
Yeah. A lot of us are at home right now, of course. What tips do you have for folks who might feel daunted by the idea of actually taking this step and starting a garden?
I tell people, don't be intimidated. It's soil. It's always been here. And I say, actually, we are soil. We're carbon. You know, we turn back into soil. And I, one of the things I do, I tell people, think of the forest. You know, why is that? The soil in the forest is so cushy and spongy and beautiful because no one's there tilling it and turning it, and they're not putting additives in it. I tell people to be the forest. That's how you want your garden to be. You want your garden to have that kind of loamy, luxurious, sexy soil. There are no mistakes. There are only lessons.
Yeah, and a big thing with that is you kind of give people permission to do this. And what I mean by that is that I don't have a backyard. So, you know, I find it completely daunting. What do you mean a garden? I don't even have a plot of land in the back to be able to do something like this. But what you teach people is that you can use, you know, these little beds. You can use just every day like a drawer to plant a garden and put it on your back porch, and you'll have actually fresh food, not, you know, massive amounts, but you will have what you need. I just found that to be something that was really great in taking that first step.
When people think of gardens, they always think of these large swaths of land, and they don't think of a wooden shoebox, a wine crate, a milk crate that you can line with cardboard or weed cloth, and they're deep enough that you can have so many different assorted vegetables and different kinds of greens and lettuce growing out of these boxes. You can grow squash out of a little box because squash doesn't grow in the box. It travels. So you might all of a sudden you have squash all over your lawn from one little box. And these are the things I want people to be creative. I want people I want you to find the answers and be creative. Be creative with the process, because this is, to me, it's an art form and it's fun. Don't just go one way and one person has all the answers. No, because it might not work for you. You might find something that somebody else didn't think about, where you have, you know, watermelons hanging from your roof or something. I don't know.
Is that possible?
I want people. Oh, yes. Of course, it's everything. Of course, it's possible. And that's once you get in the garden, you realize that almost everything is possible. And it could be so small, and it could be a tin can.
And we learned that. Like, we learned that in elementary school, that, like, you can grow a little stalk of something out of a can. You're right.
Yeah, but we forgot that because we became grown-ups. you know, in elementary school, we grew the bean in the petri dish with the wet paper yep. towel, and you saw the amazing bean that literally destroyed itself, and it gave you a bean plant. And it's like, whoa, you know, it's like magic. But that's it. They didn't take us to the other part, which is the part that all of us need to know, which is the part where you get fed, whereas, okay, take that bean sprout and put it in the ground, and you're going to have hundreds of other beans. They didn't give us that lesson because we didn't have gardens at our school. So
yeah.
imagine going through life with all these half lessons. It's and that's what happened. But I want everybody to have the full lesson. I want everybody to have the opportunity to get their hands in the soil.
For me, I found that gardening is not just about growing food. It's also a form of meditation. What are your thoughts?
I make compost. You know, when I first made it, I thought you just put all the stuff in a bucket and cover it and it turns to compost. No, it rots. Okay. And it stinks. But I learned how to make compost and it changed my life because I'm like, okay, nothing ever dies. You know, I put these dead leaves in here with these green leaves, the nitrogen and the carbon together, and bam, it turns to 150 degrees. So what is dead? So it made me look at life itself differently.
That's Ron Finley. He's a gardener and creator of the Ron Finley Project. Ron, thank you so much.
Oh, no, thank you. I so appreciate you guys.
You may have heard recently how NPR's Kelsey Snell started up her car after weeks of working from home to discover that rats had moved into the engine, perhaps on a little pandemic getaway. My pest control officer said he'd heard that car makers used peanut oil in new car wiring. Maybe the rats were after that. Oh, why did I have a pest control person? Well, because my yard, specifically the bird feeder, had become the new takeout place for a little mischief, which, by the way, I've learned is what a group of rats is called, a mischief, and they do much more than that. Let's explain with Robert Villamil, owner of Crow Pest Control in Chicago. And Robert, I'm told these infestations are happening because of the pandemic, because of restaurants?
Well, yes, that has a lot to do with it. We've always had, you know, a bit of a rat problem. But with this COVID-19, what I find is that there is a scarcity of food. Restaurants are operating less, so there's less food in the dumpsters, which used to overflow, and that was very easily accessible to the rodents. So what we're finding now is that they're doing whatever they can to get their needs met. So they're finding their way into residential neighborhoods. I'm getting calls from customers that have never had a rodent issue before, and all of a sudden we're getting rodents in their yard, in their garage, coming underneath their deck.
Well, and as I chatted with my pest control guy in the middle of the day, they were scurrying around. Now, these are supposed to be nocturnal animals. What else are you seeing going on that's unusual?
Well, they have become pretty brazen. We do see them now in large numbers. People are seeing them get onto their back porch. People tend to leave their garbage outside overnight. I've seen rats getting into people's yards, even into people's homes. More so now than ever before.
Yeah. You've had an uptick in residential calls, which maybe be making up for the business you're losing from restaurants. But rats, you know, yes, they are creatures. But unlike others that might be in your yard, they carry disease. They destroy property. They will eat their way into your house.
Absolutely. They cause millions of dollars of damage. Rats will chew wiring. They can get into vehicles in the garage. They can cause a fire to a home after they chew wiring. So rats can cause a lot of damage.
And by the way, you can see if they're there because you can look for burrows, places where they've dug out from a wall, for instance.
Absolutely. There will be evidence of rats in your yard. You will see burrows. You will actually see the rats. You will see droppings. Sometimes there's a smell. They do urinate a lot, and you have a strong urine smell on your property, maybe in your yard or in your garage.
Well, as my fellow said to me, there's a reason for the phrase smells like a rat, because they do, but they do carry disease. So bird feeders attract them. You mentioned garbage. What else can people do to remove the source of the food they want?
Sure. Well, some of the things that are important to do is they're compost. A lot of people do compost, and I would say maybe turning your compost regularly. Any new scraps or additions to the compost should be sprayed with water to kind of keep that smell minimal. If you decide to have a garden, you know, it's important if the vegetables are ripe, right away to pick them up. If you have cucumbers or apples, it's important that none of that touch the ground because it's easily accessible to rats. There's other plants that you can grow in your yard that'll help to kind of keep the rats away. Rosemary is one. Marigolds, peppermint, lavender. Power washing your dumpsters, your garbage cans every so frequently, maybe twice a month in the summer, will help keep, you know, the garbage smell down. Your overhead door, your garage door, if you have one, you want to make sure the threshold is sealed up properly and it comes flush with the ground. Water. Rats need at least an ounce to an ounce and a half of water every day, so a bird bath, not only a feeder, a bird bath can definitely attract rats. Rats can go a few days without food if they need to, but they do need a water source. Rats can actually cannibalize. When the food becomes very scarce, rats have a hierarchy, and, you know, the bigger, stronger rats will start to eat the weaker, younger ones, for lack of a better term. If you have a dog or any pets, you want to make sure you clean up after them properly. Dog feces will attract rats. So there are a lot of things people can do to kind of help discourage rats from coming, to make it unfriendly for them. If we do that, then the chances of getting rid of the rats or, you know, slowing them down are high.
Robert Villamil, just real quick, whenever we speak of rats, we have to implore people again. The EPA says rat poison poisons 10,000 kids a year. I had a dog who got into a bag of rat poison pellets someone had in their garage. It was a terrible death. There are beloved hawks killed every year, pale male in New York, Ruby the red-tailed hawk in Boston. But dry ice used in a box that attracts the rats but then puts them to sleep with the gas that's emitted from the dry ice. Is that something that you think we can be looking at?
Well, I believe a few cities have explored the dry ice option. I believe the Environmental Protection Agency, you know, has to come up with some material data sheets and some safety data sheets before it can be used, you know, nationwide. So there are some studies that still need to be done, and I think once that happens, you know, we'll be good to go. And I think that's another great alternative to rat poison.
Robert Villamil, who owns Crow Pest Control in Chicago, talking about the rat infestations happening as a result of restaurants not having as much garbage as they used to during the pandemic. Robert, thank you so much.
Thank you.